Thank you, Sue, and welcome, counsel, to the Court of Appeals, January 20. I'm Judges Riley and Rodenberg joining me, Judge Sleater, in this third of three oral matters we're considering today, and then we have two non-oral matters that we'll convene to discuss afterwards as well. Counsel, you should be able to see the time clock in the corner or somewhere in your screen, so we'll follow the normal procedures. And any separate recording is prohibited, but the recording of this matter will be available on our judicial branch's website within 24 hours. We do ask that you identify yourself and who you're representing when you begin your comments. I will note for our record that this is file A210637. Robert Thomas Brown is the petitioner respondent, Catherine Charlene Brown appellant. And so, counsel for appellant, you may identify yourself and proceed. Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Kaynard Hunt, and I represent the appellant, Catherine Brown. Property acquired during the marriage, which includes pension plan benefits, is marital property to be divided on marital dissolution. The overall property division need not be equal, but it must be just and equitable. As the Minnesota Supreme Court has declared, an equal division of the wealth accumulated through the joint efforts of the parties is presumptively appropriate on dissolution of a long-term marriage. During the parties' long-term marriage of over 30 years, both parties worked outside the home and in addition raised three children. The unequal property division in this case, less than 22% of the marital property awarded to appellant, is not just and equitable and is an abuse of discretion. The trial court's conclusion to award respondent the entirety of his pension, which is the overwhelmingly largest marital asset, is against logic and the fact of record. The trial court's division does not have an acceptable basis in fact and principle. Appellant requests reversal and remand for redivision of the party's assets. Appellant was employed in the nursing field industry for 35 years.
I'm sorry, before you go on to that, just one question about the percentages that you're using. In reading through the various findings of the court and even in the motion to amend, I get the impression the court was a little frustrated with the lack of clarity or lack of, because there's no agreement of the numbers and the valuations in order to come to, and that included the credit cards too, to some extent, where she made the phrase that she didn't want to do a forensic, I think that was the phrase used. I guess my question is, do you believe it's the numbers are undisputed such that between the distribution that the 80-20, I think is the phrase you use, is we can assume that to be true? In other words, we begin our analysis?
You can assume that to be true. Because what I did is I'm taking what the stated value according to the trial court of the pensions. I'm stating the equity in the home and as divided, and subtracting out from that the marital debt that was assessed against the appellant. So I think the numbers are good.
I have a question about the survivorship benefit that I understand that the parties selected under the husband's pension. Was the value of the survivor benefit ever analyzed by the district court and awarded to Ms. Brown?
It was not analyzed. There was a survivor benefit that the parties agreed to in 2015. But of course, the appellant would not receive that unless the respondent predeceases her.
And right, if right, but she's younger than he is, and consequently, it seems like there would be an ascertainable value to that asset.
There was no argument made by respondent with regard to assigning any value to that. What was assigned was a value to the carpenter's pension of approximately, I think, it was $705,000 or
$702,000. Ms. Nordhunt, was there ever a valuation date? I couldn't find it in the record.
You know, Your Honor, I looked for one too. I believe the court was utilizing the date of separation because the court states in with regard to debt, that was how the court separated it, but I did not see one either. Going to the record in this case, what the record shows is appellant was employed in the nursing field industry for 35 years, but left employment in May 2017 when she became very ill and had surgery. She was unemployed prior to the party's separation and unemployed when the parties separated. Respondent was employed during the marriage as a carpenter. Although respondent testified he retired in 2015 at age 59, that actually contradicts his petition for marriage dissolution filed in February 2018, paragraph Roman numeral 13, where he states in 2018, he was still employed. He was receiving his carpenter's pension, but was allowed 800 hours per year of employment. And respondent submitted at trial exhibit document 133, CRT-001L, pay stubs for carpentry work in May 2018. And on the party's tax returns also submitted by respondent at CRT-001T, it shows respondent was deducting business expenses after 2015. Now, the reasoning of the trial court for its inequitable distribution is its conclusion that by awarding respondent his entire pension valued at over $700,000, respondent will have an income stream equivalent to appellant's income, assuming she is employed, allowing respondent to meet his reasonable expenses. And the trial court then further reasons that giving appellant the majority of the proceeds from the home, $125,000, that gives her the ability to pay off the marital credit card debt and will be an offset to not receiving any of respondent's pension. So the result is an inequitable 22-78% split. Now the trial court, by its stated reasoning in inequitably dividing the marital property, didn't look at the length of the marriage. It didn't factor in that during this long-term marriage, both contributed through employment and are of similar age. They're both now in their 60s at the time of the judgment and decree. There's no recognition by the trial court of the conclusive presumption in Minnesota Statute 518.58 Subdivision 1 that each made a substantial contribution to income and property while living together, i.e. before December 2017. Instead, what the trial court did, it focused on the trial court's view of the party's situation after separation, based on its conclusion of income resulting in this inequitable award. But even if we look at the here and now, the division is inequitable. With respondent's carpenter's pension, his military pension, plus Social Security, he grosses $6,283 a month. Both parties are in their 60s, so respondent's number is not going to go down, regardless of any lack of employment on his part. In contrast, in order for appellant to have income equivalent to that of respondent under the trial court's reasoning, which would only be short term because appellant's also in her 60s, she would need to continue to work, and the trial court attributed to appellant $5,600 a month in gross income from employment. So we have respondent retiring at before age 60 and grosses $6,283 a month. An appellant in her 60s at the time of divorce must continue to work but receives 22% of the marital assets. So now what happens when appellant retires? Under the trial court's division, after appellant's income from employment goes away, she's left with Social Security and $559 a month from her nursing pension. And even if the court were going to attribute to her income from the portion of the home proceeds awarded to her, assuming $100,000 because the court recognized the marital debt had to be subtracted, so let's assume a 4% return, that gives her an additional $333 a month. So respondent on retirement sits with an absolute $6,283 a month, with, according to the trial court, living expenses of $4,550 a month or a $2,000 a month surplus. Appellant, after retirement, sits with $559 from her pensions plus $333, assuming investment of the $100,000, and let's attribute to her Social Security of $1,770 a month equal to that of respondent. So she has $2,669 a month with, according to the trial court, $3,380 a month in expenses, leaving a monthly deficit of $700 a month, even though the undisputed facts are that she contributed equally, if not more, through her employment throughout the marriage. And so this disparity, which is based on this 78-22% split award, is not equitable.
With regard to all those numbers in them, was it an error for the court? It seemed like the court did explain that if the split of the pension would somehow occur, let's presumptively assume 50%, that it would adversely affect then his pension, that I think the judge even said that he would probably need spousal maintenance. Was that kind of an analysis appropriate for the court to consider a marital distribution?
I don't think it was appropriate. One, the respondent in his petition for marriage dissolution said he was not seeking spousal maintenance. But let's look at the trial court's analysis of that. The trial court says if appellant received half a respondent's pension account, his income would be reduced to $4,470 and put him in a situation where he would need spousal maintenance from appellant. I really don't know how the trial court came up with that. The trial court found respondent's living expenses were $4,550. So we're talking about an $80 a month shortfall. So based on this $80 a month shortfall, and that's assuming that respondent never does any carpentry work again, appellant receives 0% of the carpenter's pension and only 22% of the assets. I mean, it makes absolutely no sense that this calculation, when there wasn't even a spousal maintenance issue before the court, that somehow this $80 a month shortfall results in this huge inequitable split. And so what occurred here is not fair and equitable, and the trial court's division does not have an acceptable basis in fact and principle. Now, there are other errors in the trial court's award as set out in appellant's brief, but not certainly of the magnitude of the inequitable division of the assets. I do want to briefly mention the trial court's award to respondent of $25,000 for his share of alleged personal property he did not receive. It has absolutely no support in the record and is actually contrary to the record.
The husband used a smaller amount, as I recall the record, $7,000 or something like that, as things that he wasn't able to get out of the house.
That's exactly right, Your Honor. So what respondent put in his own exhibit saying he retrieved $15,947.67 worth, and he didn't retrieve, and this is his own numbers, $7,124. So now how do we get to an award of $25,000 for the unretrieved property that the only thing that's of record is what respondent himself valued at $7,124? Again, it doesn't make any sense on this record. Based on the record before this court, the trial court's division of the assets is unfair, is inequitable, and it is an abuse of discretion. And appellant is requesting for reversal and remand for an appropriate division. Thank you.
Thank you. I see no other questions. And you'll have 5 minutes, Ms. Hunt, for a rebuttal if you choose. Counsel for respondent, if you would identify yourself for a record, you may proceed.
Good morning, Your Honors. Bill Thompson on behalf of the respondent, Robert Brown. Obviously, you are going to see contentious divorces from time to time come before the appellate courts. There is no question that this was one of those contentious divorces. It took roughly a good 2.5-3 years for this divorce to get completed. It involved initially an order for protection that was eventually dismissed. It also involved an HRO that was eventually dismissed. And during that particular time, my client was excluded from the home. I disagree with opposing counsel, respectively, as to whether or not the court did an adequate division of the marital property. I think, as would you would expect from opposing counsel, I think they forget a couple of things that the court did consider. Obviously, we all want to put the best foot forward for our clients when making these arguments, but I think there's a couple of findings that are particularly important here in this case. In looking at that 80-20 split, opposing counsel doesn't include the roughly $117,000 in dissipated assets that the court specifically found Ms. Brown did during the pendency of the divorce. The court made specific findings that the respondent was voluntarily the appellant was voluntarily underemployed during this matter, and then used those marital funds to then use to pay on a homestead throughout this
matter. Mr. Thompson, can I ask you about that? I believe appellant's counsel points this out, but what would be the relevance in a marital property distribution of whether one is unemployed or not, or even willfully unemployed or not? It seems like more of a child support, or if there was a need for spousal maintenance, we see that sort of language being used, but we don't. It seems unusual in a property distribution. And if I recall the record correctly, both sides had some investment money they did have to spend, which is typical when all of a sudden you're separated and you split the property and income.
So the issue in this particular matter, Your Honor, was, you know, the parties owned a house. My client had that house valued somewhere between $580 and $625. There was no question that that was the biggest expense that the parties had. My client, throughout this matter, had been trying to sell the house because, knowing going into the divorce, neither of these parties were going to be able to afford that property on their own. The appellant in this matter, and this is where I disagree with opposing counsel's argument that credibility doesn't come into play, is the appellant always tried to thwart the sale of that house. And I think in the court's final distribution, knowing that it was her trying to thwart the sale of this house, ended up selling the house to her new significant other at a value just because my client wanted to be done and get this over with. It never even got put on the market because after the court ordered it sold, the appellant still refused to sell the house. And so throughout all of that, that's where I think that while I agree with you, the underemployed generally comes into the issue of maintenance or child support. In this particular one, based upon the appellant's actions, it was relevant because had she been working, she wouldn't necessarily have had to dissipate all of those marital funds that my client would have been entitled to half. And there was a huge discrepancy between the amount of retirement account my client expended in attorney's fees and paying off some of their other joint debt and what the appellant spent. In addition,
Mr. Thompson,
go ahead, sir.
Just to follow up a bit, my question earlier, I'm assuming, at least I didn't see it in your client's brief, that your client does not disagree with the approximate 80-20 distribution. And so my assuming that to be true, I assume you would agree that we at least have to look at it with, although we don't have to have it, we know percentages don't have to be 50-50. It's not a mathematical. That certainly is a disparity. Well, within a number of cases in the past, our court has reversed for various reasons. What's your best pitch to us that an 80 to 20% is appropriate? And what's the specific basis that you would point us to in the judge's findings that would make it appropriate? And I'm assuming I leading off this question with things such as whether thwarting a sale or the judge even honestly say, I'm not sure how you're going to afford it, really aren't those sort of issues we can look at, because that's just a judge's opinion, but it's, and it might well be true, but it wouldn't be the appropriate consideration for a court to decide how to divide marital property, I assume.
And I apologize, Your Honor, because maybe I'm not being extremely clear, but I'm not, like I said, convinced that the 80-20 is the appropriate number. It's 80-20 based on the numbers provided by opposing counsel. But as I just indicated, if you look at what the court made specific findings about the voluntarily underemployed and the $117,000 in dissipated assets, that then should have went into appellant's column.
What I'm getting at is, what do we look at in the record to add up some numbers you would point us to shift 80-20 to, let's say, 60-40? I'm assuming underemployment can't be that. As I say, that seems like an unrelated issue.
Okay. So just to make it really clear, I think two numbers that I think need to be shifted into appellant's column when looking at that 80-20 breakdown is, one, the $117,000 in assets that she dissipated. And two, I think you need to include in there the $60,000 to roughly $100,000 lesser value that the house was sold at, despite the appraisals that were provided to the court, because my client was then forced to sell the property at a lesser value to the appellant's significant other just to get this thing moving forward and done.
Do we have any findings by the district court that would support that second line of reasoning? That is to say that the house ended up being sold at less than the fair market value.
Finding 22 is where that is discussed, Your Honor, on page 8 of the court's finding. And in there specifically, it talks about multiple appraisals over the years with values ranging from 445 to 617. The house did not go on the open market, so the true value was never known. Without agreement from the respondent, the house could not be sold. In 2019, after much haggling, the petitioner agreed to sell the house for $525 to respondent or her agency to free himself from responsibility. There is no doubt that the petitioner was stuck without options for nearly 3 years while respondent drew this matter out. During this time, she had three attorneys refuse to get the house on the market with the value to be determined by the market. Meanwhile, petitioner had no ability to abstract himself from the responsibility for the cost of the house, but also had no power or control in making decisions about the house.
That sounds like no. The district court did not make a finding that the fair market value of the house was something greater than the amount for which it was sold.
I see what you're saying. As a specific finding, that is correct, Judge. But I think when you look at that particular paragraph, it gives the court in review an understanding of where this, the difficulties that were in this particular matter, and why the court made some of these findings that it did.
Right, but the values in that paragraph range from 445 to 617, and the sale price fell within that range.
It did.
Let me, if I can just turn to the question of the value, if any, of the wife's survivor's benefit. You didn't put in any evidence on that, did you?
I did not, Your Honor.
Why not?
To be honest with you, Judge, I don't know. It was just something that was missed at the time of trial. I mean, we were still trying to negotiate and get this matter resolved, and that was just something that was missed at that particular point.
She still has that, though, right?
That is correct, Judge. That can't be changed at this point in time.
Right. Once he retires, that locks in. He can't change the beneficiary, whatever. He can't change the amount that she would get, what have you.
That is correct. And obviously, as Ms. Hunt pointed out, it does depend upon whether my client predeceases the appellant or not. But obviously, he is older than the appellant.
And is also male. I mean, ordinarily, females live longer than males, and younger people live longer than older people.
Correct. Although knowing that I'm getting to be older, I'm hoping that's not necessarily correct.
Well, I join you in that, but I mean, that is the sort of the reality of the of life. And I'm a little puzzled as to why nothing was put in. I guess there's no good reason, but then don't we have an omitted asset here?
Yes. I mean, I can't look at it any other way. Like I said, Judge, there is no good explanation for it. It was just something both myself and opposing counsel missed when we were trying this particular matter. Because, you know, to be honest with you, Judge, we were so focused on the ongoing fight with that homestead and what we were going to do. I think we just lost sight of it, and there's no excuse for it.
You agree that the district court has to treat the pension or pensions, as it were, as property, right?
I don't necessarily agree with that, Judge. I think the court has the option to treat it as either an income stream or as an asset. And in this particular matter, I think the court treated it as an income stream.
I tend to agree that that's the way the court treated it. Where's the authority in the cases for that notion that you can flip it from an asset into an income stream and not treat it as a marital asset?
I apologize, Your Honor. I'm looking through my brief. I believe it was the Crushell case, Your Honor, that I cited in that particular instance as being able to treat that as an income stream.
But the statute clearly says that it is an asset. At least that's my reading of the statute.
And, you know, and obviously the court will make the decision on that particular point, but I don't believe, like I said before, that even if you do that, that I don't believe the distribution of the assets is as disparative as Ms. Hunt indicates in her arguments here before the court. You know, and I think when you look at the totality of the complications in this matter, the totality of what was indicated by the court as to the, you know, Ms. Brown's or the appellant's conduct in this particular matter, the court failed to look at the issue of attorney's fees because we had requested attorney's fees based upon her bad faith conduct. That's another issue that potentially could have gone into my client's column or into the distribution of these assets. But because of the way the trial court looked at things, didn't consider that particular issue. And so, you know, I mean, I think when you look at what Ms. Hunt's stating, I mean, there are certain things that are undisputed. I mean, we know what the net proceeds were from the sale of the homestead. We know what documents were submitted and what assets were there. But, you know, trying to say what equity was in a vehicle, I mean, those were disputed, but we have the trial court's findings. But there are certain things that still would have gone into the appellant's column that shrinks that 80-20 down to a value that is closer, regardless of whether you treat it as an income stream or an asset.
Well, we do have, though, conclusion of law number 14, where the district court ordered each party to pay his or her own attorney's fees and costs. So I don't know that we can disregard that finding and then sub in that number as something that the court could have done, which would have justified what it did do.
Well, but I think when you read, when you read on page 9, finding 29, the court could easily find respondent was responsible for the length of proceedings and therefore the cost. However, awarding the cost would make dividing the proceeds from the sale of the house all the more contentious. So I guess I disagree with that particular piece, Judge. I mean, I know what the conclusion is. I'm not arguing with that. But I think when you read the findings under the issues of attorney's fees, had things been different, the court would have awarded attorney's fees. Thank you, Your Honors. I appreciate your time.
Thank you, counsel. And now, counsel for appellant, once you see the 5 minutes, you may proceed with rebuttal.
I would like to first turn to this issue of dissipation. There was no dissipation, and the trial court didn't find dissipation, nor could it. If the court looks to finding 19 on the addendum page 15, the court says each party depleted certain pension retirement accounts to support themselves during these proceedings. Technically, each party would have been entitled to half of the other person's accounts. And so what happened in this case is the respondent actually spent down like $60,000 worth of retirement assets, even though he was getting this pension and all of this. But the, you know, so there wasn't a dissipation. Each, according to the trial court, everybody's using it to support themselves, and there's no dispute. An appellant has put in the record in detail that she was paying the mortgage, she was paying the insurance, she paid his some of his car expenses, she paid for health insurance. I mean, how can you find that there's dissipation? You can't, based on this record. Turning to the house, there's no obligation to sell a house until it's ordered sold by the trial court. That didn't occur until June of 2020. Ultimately, the parties stipulated to the sale in a set amount. I mean, there's absolutely no record basis for the idea that respondent was forced into this. He stipulated to the sale, and the number is actually is within the range of the appraisal, and it's actually less than what was earlier offered to the respondent, which he refused. So it just makes no sense somehow that this house somehow comes into the issue of the division of the marital property. With regard to the pension being income or property, the Minnesota legislature has made clear that it is property. Minnesota statute section 518.003 subdivision 3B states that explicitly. What respondent refers to are the situations where you have a pension that is awarded as marital property, and then there's a claim later on with spousal maintenance having been awarded, whether you can use the income from that property to pay spousal maintenance. That's where it comes into play. Well, here, appellant was not awarded spousal maintenance. She didn't ask for spousal maintenance. So the pension is clearly marital property, and that was how it was supposed to be treated. The trial court, unfortunately, looks like she treats it at some point as an asset and other points as income. But as I stated in going through the numbers, either way, it certainly doesn't justify this 80-20 split. And the 80-20 split is accurate because respondent wants to ignore that both parties utilized marital assets during the separation to pay their living expenses. So if you take both of those out of the equation, you have this split. But even if you wanted to put them back in, you have to put in the $60,000 that respondent utilized. So you still end up with approximately the same split any way you look at it. So I ask that this court reverse and remand for a just and equitable division of the assets.
Thank you, both counsel. We appreciate your answers to our questions and your briefing in the matter. We will now take the matter under advisement and issue an order within the statutory timeline. And we will be adjourning now to consider our non-oral balance of our non-oral calendar. You each have a good day. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.